From KCRW and KCRW.com, I'm Evan Kleiman, and this is Good Food. Salsa, it's not just a condiment. A Mexico City native explains the immense world of salsas today on the show. A food critic offers advice on how to write a better Yelp review. Plus, I know it's hard to believe, but apple season is already upon us. And what can you do with all those crab apples? But first, let's head to the Santa Monica Farmers Market to see what else is in season this warm week in Southern California.
This is Laura Avery with the Market Report. You know, there's a lot of seasonal things here that people might not realize are coming and going, one of which is the tomatillo. And we're talking with Josiah Citron, of course, chef owner of the Michelin-starred Melisse restaurant right here in Santa Monica. And Josiah, you're cooking with tomatillos. Now, I think a lot of people think of salsa. They wouldn't think of a Michelin-starred restaurant. So what are you doing with tomatillos?
Right now, we're using tomatillos as a sauce. So what we do is we'll blend them, and we'll blend them maybe with some triple blanched garlic, which is garlic that has been blanched in cold water, bring it to a boil three different times. It takes a little of the astringency out of it and helps the digestion of it. So we'll blend that with raw tomatillos, and we like the purple ones. They're just starting to come through at Jaime Farms. So we'll blend that, and then we'll heat some oil, or if you're going to do it for a meat dish, you'd heat the fat of that animal. Like if it's pig, you know, pork, you might heat, pork fat, and then you're going to heat the oil really hot, smoking hot, and then you'll pour the tomatillo sauce in, and it just fries it really fast. We take it out and put it over a bowl of ice in another bowl to stop the cooking and keep the beautiful color. And obviously, you can add basil to that. You could add cilantro to the puree, parsley, depending on what you want to do. Right now, we're serving with fish. And we like to kind of coat the fish in a spicy crust, a split pepper. So we kind of sprinkle that over the fish. So it really gives a nice spiciness. Kind of, you know, it gives that Latin style of cuisine, but we keep it in a French way that works in the style of food that we do to match with wine. So it's really a kind of a fun ingredient to play with. And anything seasonal is so exciting because you see it for 3 months, and then it's gone. And then it's like one whole year of not seeing it, and the inspiration when it comes out is just amazing.
And what does a tomatillo look like, and what do they taste like?
Okay. A tomatillo looks like a green tomato in a shell, I mean, in a little leaf. They're really pretty. They're a little sticky. I find that they have a almost like a sweet bitterness, that's how I say it. So a lot of times we do add a little sugar in them, kind of to bring out a little more of the sweetness if they're too bitter. It's a lovely flavor.
They come in all different sizes. They've got little ones, a size of, you know, large marbles, all the way up to like an orange. Do you pick one size?
I mean, since we're pureeing them, we try to find, you know, we're going to cut them into quarters before we puree it. So we just try to find ones that are kind of equal sizes, not too soft. I mean, we look for the more like medium firmness, not too hard, not too soft.
Well, that sounds great. I'm just wondering, once you throw this puree into a hot oil, does it get hard? Does it congeal? What does it look like?
No, but that's one thing I must say. When you do it, you kind of want to have a lid near to kind of throw the lid over so that it doesn't splatter everywhere. It just kind of fries and bubbles, and you mix it, and it kind of thickens a little bit and binds together.
Wow. And then you take it right out of the pan and pour it right on fat and all, just everything.
Everything. Well, the fat emulsifies right into it.
Okay. Well, that's an amazing use for tomatillos. Fascinating.
Thank you very much.
That was Josiah Citron, and he is the chef owner of the 2-star Michelin restaurant Melisse right here in Santa Monica. And he's using tomatillos, which are in season now at the farmer's market, in a very unique French way. Ruth Jaime is the farmer that Josiah was talking about, where he gets his tomatillos. And Ruth, you don't have that many left. Are you selling a lot right now? And they seem to be, the ones you have right now seem to be fairly small. Were they becoming in different sizes?
That actual variety is called the tomatillo milpero. It only comes in small. It's always tiny, sweet as soon as it ripens, and stays sweet all the way around. Versus the bigger tomatillo, that one you have to wait for it to ripen a little bit more. It has a kind of a, like a sour, sweet taste. The milpero doesn't. It's always nice and sweet.
And how do you tell if it's ripe?
Once it fills up the pocket, tomatillos come in the little pockets. Once it fills up the pocket, that's when you know it's ready and ripe.
So will you be bringing the bigger variety later?
Yes, because we do grow both varieties. Obviously, the milpero came a lot faster, and we're getting a lot more of it, so we're trying to get rid of it as fast as we can. But then the other one, the bigger one, will come eventually.
And Josiah was explaining to us how he cooks them. It seems like the little ones would be a little more work to prep because they're tiny. Is that what you find? Do you cook them yourself?
I definitely cook it myself, and he's absolutely right. It's tedious. It's tedious to grow, it's tedious to pick, and it's tedious to cook with. but all the more rewarding because it's such a taste. It's a really good scrumptious taste that you can't get from any other tomato, tomatillo, or anything else. It has its own unique sweet flavor.
Are they hard to grow?
It needs a lot of sun. It needs a lot of sun, so it won't grow during the winter. It won't grow in the spring. It needs to grow just in the summer where we're getting a lot of sun, but then it requires a lot of water. So then you have to make sure that you're always watering it enough and that it's getting enough sun. So you always have to be watching that with the tomatillo. If it's not getting enough sun, you're not going to produce enough tomatillos.
And what is the season altogether for all your tomatillos?
Mainly the summer. So it goes anywhere from May, you can start planting it, and you can end the harvest maybe as November, end of October, because you can also store it. It's also storable.
Oh, okay. Well, how would you store it?
Just outside. Don't refrigerate it. Don't put it in a wet area. Just put it in a box, cardboard box preferably, and just store it in a dry area. You can store it for up to 2 weeks.
With the little paper skin still on. Okay.
Yes, with the skin still on, yeah.
Okay. Well, it sounds like something to try. It's different, especially this little variety you have now, which is even different than the larger tomatillo. So thanks for that information.
Oh, no problem.
That was Ruth Jaime. She's a farmer who grows the two varieties of tomatillos. And the Jaime farm you can find at several markets here in the Los Angeles area. Be sure to join us at the Pico Farmers Market on Saturday, September 14th from 9 till noon. We're going to be doing 3 sustainable food workshops, family food on a budget. We're going to be showing how to shop and cook from the farmers market, even if you're on a food stamp budget. It's going to be at the Pico Farmers Market at Cloverfield Park. 3 presentations, 1 at 9, 1 at 10, and 1 at 11. You can come on down. It's completely free, open to the public, and it's going to be informational and hopefully entertaining as well. For the Market Report, this is Laura Avery.
When you see tomatillos at the market, those beautiful green little babies covered in that weird papery skin, what do you think of? Salsa? Maybe a tangy cooked salsa verde or a bright fresh chipotle and tomatillo salsa? Those are just 2 ideas from Mexico City native Patty Jenich. Patty gave up her career as a policy analyst to commit to the kitchen. She now hosts the show Patty's Mexican Table on PBS, and she has a cookbook of the same name. She joins me now to school us in the ways of salsa.
If you open the refrigerator of, I would bet, any Mexican, it is very likely that you would find 2 competing salsas, a green salsa based on tomatillo, and a red salsa that has its main ingredient, the red tomato. And they compete so much for supremacy that there are many dishes in Mexican cooking that are called divorced because people just can't make up their minds and they will pour half of the plate with the green salsa and half of the plate with the red salsa.
I've always wondered what divorciado meant.
Yeah, it is. It is. You know, Mexicans, we have a very sarcastic sense of humor, and we turn to laughing at things that are hurtful. I mean, take this coming from a woman that grew up in a family of divorced parents. It's a painful thing, but we eat the divorced eggs and we make an even bigger mess out of them, and it ends up being really tasty. But salsas, I think it's such a fabulous topic, Evan, because I think across the border, outside of Mexico, people have not realized how huge salsas are, what a big tool they can be in the kitchen, how versatile they can be. So they're a condiment, but they're much more than that.
So let's start with the basic types, and then we can go on to talk about their role. The typical salsa roja, how would you go about making it? Do you use the charring technique or do you boil?
So I think to start with the basic, we have to talk about the pico de gallo. And the pico de gallo is a traditional chunky and raw salsa. You know, the pico de gallo is a salsa that you will see along the side of chips in so many restaurants today. And it has the 3 main ingredients, the red tomato, white onion, and jalapeño, and many times cilantro, all chopped and mixed together with a little lime juice and salt and sometimes oil. So that's your basic start. From there, you go to the cooked versions of salsas. My favorite way of making a red salsa is boiling the red tomatoes, jalapeño or serrano chili, garlic clove. And then once it's all cooked and mushy and soft, you put it in the blender, add a little bit of raw onion, salt, and there you have a delicious red salsa. And that can be a condiment. But that salsa, Evan, can also be the base of a stew, say shredded flank steak and potatoes, or it can be the base of some potato and spinach enchiladas. Or it can also be the thing that you whiz on some eggs on a Sunday morning. And it really varies depending on how you use it, how it'll taste.
Now, what is the role of the white onion in all of this instead of the yellow onion?
So you're touching on a sensitive point. Mexicans, we use white onions. We love white onions. And the only region in Mexico that doesn't use white onions and uses more red onions is the Yucatan Peninsula. But the white onion is crisp, it's fresh, and it's not sweet. So we're always surprised when we see Mexican recipes with the yellow onions because they're great for Spanish food, we think. But for Mexican food, we need that crunch and punch and pungency of the white onion.
Which seems to complement so much the lime, which is in so many sauces as well.
Exactly, which is, you're touching on all like the crucial elements. We use limes and not lemons. Again, lemons are very sweet. Limes are, you know, much tartar and have like a bigger citrusy punch and they make your eyes wink, right? Much more than lemons. So you would use limes on raw salsas, which are the pico de gallos, which actually nobody knows where the name pico de gallo comes from, which is very funny.
Now let's talk for a minute about the green salsas with the tomatillos. I think many of us are used to cooked salsa verde. So right. What goes into that?
And that is my favorite salsa of all time, Evan. The green salsa or salsa verde is as simple as can be. You grab a pound of tomatillos, you put them in a medium saucepan, cover them with water, add a garlic clove, and then again, your choice of either jalapeño chile or serrano if you want it to be a little bit more spicy. And you just boil it for like 10 minutes until it is, all of the ingredients in there are very soft and mushy. And then you put them in the blender, add a slice of white onion, but raw white onion, and some cilantro and salt. And you puree it and you have your basic cooked green salsa.
Now, where does the avocado fit into all of this?
Because the avocado goes with absolutely everything. The avocado is so smooth and buttery and rich. It just tones down the heat. You know, Mexican food tends to have a lot of chilies, be them spicy or not, but they have that capsaicin element that makes your metabolism go fast and opens up your appetite and makes you salivate more. And suddenly the avocado just smooths, tones down, refreshes. It just balances out Mexican food.
Now, what about the pickles that one sees so often accompanying a plate of food? Mm. Are they ever used as a salsa?
We are crazy about pickled jalapeños and carrots in Mexico. You'll go to a restaurant and you'll see a big bowl of them and we'll just eat them on their own while the food comes. And then you tuck them into tortas and tacos and you just eat them, you know, on the side with scrambled eggs. And they are considered, you know, in the salsa category, but definitely chunkier because you have the big chunks of the jalapeños and the carrots and sometimes other vegetables. But see, the world of salsas is so wide and so varied and so immense. You have from condiments to pickles to relishes to you know, things that you just add a touch of something. You know, a salsa can be just the touch of something super sublime on a very, say, sophisticated pheasant or something very sophisticated. And it can also be the base of a stew. You know, when you think about salsas, not just a condiment like, say, ketchup or mustard, because a salsa on its own can become the whole thing that describes a dish.
Patty, I want to thank you so much for coming by.
Thank you so much for having me. I could chat with you for hours, so anytime.
Patty Jenich is the host of Patty's Mexican Table on PBS. She also has a new cookbook out of the same name. Find a recipe for her divorced eggs, plus both a salsa verde and a salsa roja recipe on the Good Food blog. What are your plans later today? If you're free, come out to cheer on the bakers at the 5th annual Good Food Pie Contest. Ann Litt will be spinning some tunes, plus we're giving out tickets for free pie tasting. But there's a catch. You have to get there early. Tickets are given out on a first-come, first-served basis. The event starts at 2 p.m. I hope to see you there. Coming up, did you know that you can eat crab apples? You might have to cook them first, but my next guest knows some tasty tips to dress up those pretty little decorator apples.
This is producer Jillian Ferguson. You can connect with other food lovers on Evan's Facebook page, share photos, ask questions, and meet new friends. Search for Evan Kleinman on Facebook and click like.
You're listening to Good Food on KCRW. Consider the apple for a minute. Can you imagine a more iconic fruit? From Adam and Eve to Sir Isaac Newton, it probably gets the prize for the most famous fruit in history. And in the kitchen, is there a more versatile fruit? I'm thinking jams, jellies, sauces, butters, and of course, pies. And believe it or not, apple season is already in full swing here in Southern California. And here to talk about this culinary workhorse is Kevin West, author of Saving the Season.
Apples are good in almost anything.
It's true. They're just amazing. So one of the things that I find so intriguing about apples is how regional the different cultivars are. What kinds of climates are most conducive for apple cultivation?
Well, the apple originally, the wild apple, came from the Caucasus. So it came from a sort of temperate four-season climate with cold winters. The apple supposedly was in the Garden of Eden, but biblical scholars doubt that because, that's not really apple country.
It's actually the pomegranate.
That's right. Apples like cold weather, and a lot of varieties require a good bit of winter chill. There are some varieties such as the Anna apple, which grow here in Southern California, which have been developed to grow in warmer climates, but it's really more of a cold weather crop.
And is the taste of those grown where they can really get a good winter chill? Not just the taste, but the texture, are they significantly different than the apples we see in our farmers' markets?
Well, that is a good question, and people in New England would tell you yes, that the only good apple is going to come from someplace where there are cold nights and where they know Robert Frost by memory. The local apples that we get in Southern California are coming from microclimates that are cooler. Oak Glen up in the San Bernardino Mountains is a little village up in the mountains that has a series of apple orchards at about 5,000 feet of elevation. Obviously, it's cooler up there. Bill and Barbara Spencer up in Paso Robles grow a wide range of heirloom apple varieties, and they get wonderful flavor out of that fruit. We think of apples as being the signature fruit of fall, or at least I think of them that way. In fact, the apple season starts in late summer, and the season runs through perhaps Thanksgiving.
So here in Southern California, talk to us a little bit about the different varieties and what you do to preserve them.
When we go through the grocery store, we tend to look at apples with our eyes. We tend to see big, beautiful, fully formed, very large apples. And that may be good for dessert apple, for eating out of hand. But for preserving, I'm more interested in two things. One is the flavor, and in particular, the tart flavors of apples, and all of that range of sort of acidity and brightness and sharpness, which is very useful in making preserves. And the other thing I'm looking for is a very firm texture, because that firm texture is an indicator of a high pectin content. One of the reasons that apple jelly is one of the most familiar jellies is because apples have enough pectin, enough naturally occurring pectin, to make to make jelly. Not all fruit has that much pectin. And pectin is a complex carbohydrate. It's a very interesting molecule. It's part of the cell structure of the fruit, which means that if a fruit has a lot of structure, if it's very crisp or very firm, then it has a lot of pectin. So when I'm choosing apples, I'm looking for those very firm, very crisp and cracking apples.
Now, I noticed in the book that you will sometimes use apple jelly as pectin to set another jam.
That's right. Some other fruits, such as cherries, for example, have quite a bit less pectin. And cherry preserves, which are made in the spring, of course, when the cherries come in, cherry preserves often need some kind of a pectin boost. And one traditional way to add that pectin boost is to use some unflavored apple jelly, some pectin stock, that you would have put up the fall before. Evan, I used to go on a tirade about how commercial pectin was an industrial product, and it was essentially a contaminant that was not necessary in any artisanal small-batch preserve. My somewhat more moderate position now is that almost all fruits have sufficient natural pectin that you can make a preserve, a jelly, a jam, a chutney, a marmalade, using just these two elemental ingredients, fruit and sugar. You have enough natural pectin to get by without, not to get by, but to succeed without any commercial pectin additive. But there's nothing inherently unnatural about apple pectin, which you can get at the health food store.
It seems like just working with apples is a great way to sort of teach ourselves about how pectin works and the set and how to recognize that setting point of pectin.
Yes, that's exactly right. Apples and apple jelly in particular is one of the best ways to really understand pectin and the way pectin works. The way you make jelly is you take fruit, high pectin fruit, apples, crab apples, quince, if you can find them, and you cook that fruit in some water. And then you strain off the water. And that water carries with it lots of flavor and lots of pectin. And you strain the fruit and the pectin stock through a jelly bag and let it drip until
drip.
until you've collected all of that stock, all of that pectin stock, and then you reduce that pectin stock with sugar. And it's a slow process until the last minute, which is when you finally get a gel set in the pan, and then the jelly wants to set up. So you have to get it into a jar very fast before it sets up, because if you're too slow, then that jelly, as it sets, will capture bubbles, and it'll get cloudy, and it'll get chunky, and it won't give you that perfectly clear, limpid, semi-solid jewel that you're looking for.
So first you have to deal with extreme boredom, and then you have to get yourself up into a frenzy to be able to accomplish this stuff really quickly.
That's right. It's boredom followed by panic.
I love that. Perfect. Perfect for the modern world. I don't think those of us in Southern California who grew up here have a really intrinsic relationship with the crab apple. It's more like something we see in the fall as a decorator item.
That's right. And even in a lot of other parts of the country, people know crab apples maybe best for their springtime blossoms. And that fruit that falls on your lawn in the winter or in the fall is just this kind of annoying thing that you have to deal with. But that's obviously not the way I look at crab apples.
Yeah, so what are they good for?
Crab apples are one of the best fruits for making jellies. And they also, because of their diminutive size, they're wonderful for preserving whole.
In a light syrup.
In a light syrup, yeah. And then it's essentially an edible garnish. You preserve them whole in a light syrup, and then you pull them out, and you can cook with them as an ingredient. You can like add them to, let's say, some sort of a chicken fricassee, some sort of a stew, or you could put them on a platter alongside a roast goose, or you could slice them up and use them in a salad.
Kevin, it's just, we could talk forever about this knowledge that you've collected in your new book, Saving the Season. Thank you so much for coming.
Thank you for having me. It's been a pleasure.
Find a crab apple recipe from Kevin West's new book, Saving the Season, on the Good Food blog. And look for crab apples the next time you're shopping your local farmer's market. Where do you shop for your groceries? Do you have a nickname for your local store? I'm in stores so often, I definitely have nicknames. Trader Joe's is TJ's.
Whole Foods is, of course, Whole Paycheck. And for me, Smart and Final is tedious and never finished. But who was Mr. Vaughn or Mrs. Albertson? Independent producer Gideon Brower did some research to find out about the men and women behind our local grocery outlets. Today he joins me in the studio and we begin with the ubiquitous Ralphs.
I was always curious about Ralphs because I wondered if there was a Ralph, why there's no apostrophe in Ralphs, if there was a Ralph, and where it's from. And I didn't grow up in Southern California, so these places were new to me, and I was curious. So Ralph's, I found out, was started in 1873 by a guy named George Albert Ralph's. And he grew up in San Bernardino. His father owned a brick company, and he himself was a champion bricklayer. But then he had a hunting accident, a mishap, and he lost part of one arm.
So he couldn't lay bricks anymore.
Apparently not. So he became a grocery clerk, which doesn't seem like it'd be all that easy with one arm either, but I guess it was better suited. And he started a grocery downtown in L.A. on 6th and Spring. He started the grocery initially with a partner. Then he and his brother bought out the partner and opened a chain of stores that was the Ralph's Brothers Markets. Eventually that became the Ralph's Grocery Company.
Was it really successful right away?
It was, from what I've read. But Ralph's himself came to an untimely end. He was an outdoorsman, and when he was in his 60s, he was at Lake Arrowhead, and a giant boulder somehow got dislodged and rolled onto his leg, and that led to his demise.
What a horrible end. Now, what about Vaughn's?
Vaughn's also was started in downtown L.A., by a Danish immigrant named Charles Vonderay. So Vons just comes from the first part of his name. So the first store was in 1906, and it was called Vons Grosseteria. And he built this into a fairly big chain and then sold it with very good timing right before the stock market crash. And then after that, a few years later, he backed his sons in a new grocery venture, and that was the Vons Grocery Company, which did have an apostrophe. But for some reason, they dropped it over the years.
So we have these other stores here that are becoming de facto supermarkets. Smart and Final recently underwent a big reorganization in terms of the types of food they sell and how the stores are organized to make them less of sort of a chef's store and more of a consumer's store. Did Smart and Final start here in L.A.?
Yes. Smart and Final was one of the ones that surprised me most because I always figured that smart and final were adjectives that described what you bought, although odd adjectives. But it turns out that there were two guys named Mr. Smart and Mr. Final.
Are you kidding?
Jim Smart and Hildane Final. And they bought an existing grocery company in 1914. And that name has survived through various mergers and acquisitions over the years.
Okay, now we come to Trader Joe's, a chain that I think of as being uniquely not only Californian, but Los Angelino. Is it, in fact?
Originally, it is. And there is a Trader Joe. His name is Joe Coulomb. And he launched a chain of convenience stores in the late 50s that were called Pronto Markets, that were a really just a straight knockoff of 7-Eleven. They were around for about 10 years, and then in around 67, he decided to try to distinguish them from other convenience stores by giving them this sort of South Seas theme. So that became then, they became Trader Joe's. And that's where you get all the nautical paraphernalia that they have in there and the fact that the Hawaiian shirts and the people who work there have naval ranks like crew member and captain. The store manager of each Trader Joe's is the captain.
I never realized that. Gideon, thank you so much.
Sure, it was a pleasure.
Gideon Brower is an independent radio producer. We've been talking about the history of Southern California supermarkets. Up next, Jonathan Gold's in the studio. He's loving a new restaurant in West Hollywood where they serve the best oysters in L.A. Stay close.
Jump into a new mode of music discovery with the KCRW Music Mine. It's our first iPad app dedicated entirely to music exploration. The Music Mine brings you an interactive experience with a constantly evolving galaxy of audio, video, and photos. Discover by artist, by DJ, or by song.
and easily share the music you love with friends. The KCRW Music Mine. Dig into it on your iPad. More info at kcrw.com.
I'm Evan Kleiman, and you're listening to Good Food. Have you noticed a trend in restaurants lately? It might involve fishing nets and buoys decorating the ceiling and a lobster roll on the menu. We can't help but notice that there are New England-style seafood shacks opening all over town. And here to discuss one of the latest additions to that genre is Jonathan Gold. He's the Pulitzer Prize-winning food writer for the LA Times, and today we're going to the largest new wave seafood shack in town, Connie and Ted's.
This is something that, like, foodies in LA have been looking forward to for a long time. I mean, Michael Cimarusti, being the chef of Providence, which a lot of people, including me, consider one of the very best restaurants in LA, has been talking about doing a Rhode Island-style clam shack, like the places he grew up going to in the summers. And I think all of us were expecting something a little deconstructed, right? Like a chef-y version of this. And he built this sort of fantastic modernist place on Santa Monica near Crescent Heights with a really nice outdoor patio and, you know, chandeliers made out of lobster buoys and walls papered with the tags from clam boxes and stuff to let you know that he's super serious about fish, which obviously he is. And it's, I think, a regular clam shack, except done by somebody who has really, really good sources for seafood and who is very particular that this is Rhode Island style as opposed to, say, Maine style.
So what would be the difference? Give me an example.
Well, I suppose you're going to want me to start with the chowder. You know, the classic New England chowder is, you know, cream or milk and oysters and bacon and potatoes. And the Manhattan style, which oddly enough, they don't actually serve anywhere in Manhattan, except maybe the Grand Central Oyster Bar, has tomatoes in it. And the Rhode Island style, or at least this his Rhode Island style, is clear with neither cream nor tomatoes, but it's sort of briny and very intensely clammy. It's not quite like drinking clam juice, but it's like if you can imagine clam juice being actually good and tasty and actually filled with potatoes and clams, then that's what this chowder would be. They give you a sampler of three so you can mix and match among yourselves.
This is the kind of menu where when I looked at it online, I said to myself, oh, you're going to be in trouble because you're just going to want to eat everything.
You are going to want to eat everything. And as is the custom with a big Rhode Island-style clam roast, they try to stuff you. For example, the stuffies, which are big clams that are chopped up with linguica sausage, a lot of garlic butter, breadcrumbs, then stuffed back into the shell and baked until it forms sort of a crisp crust. Super delicious. Not super clean as a dish. The clams are really chewy. They have clam cakes, which is a big Rhode Island thing that I've never seen anywhere here, which is like a batter with clam, chopped clams in it that's deep fried. So it comes out like clam beignet.
So it's like a fritter.
I was warned by a friend who grew up in Providence never ever to call them fritters.
Okay, I take it back. Now they have peaky toe crab cake. What are peaky toe crabs?
Peaky toe crabs are a sort of hard shell crab. I mean, they've been showing up in LA restaurants for decades. The crab cakes are probably not the call here. I've had them a couple times. They tend to be a little liquidy in the center and not, say, as crab intensive as the ones you may have had at Hungry Cat. I mean, it's still going to be good.
It's so funny. So far, we haven't even left the appetizer menu.
You can stay on the appetizer menu. It's not necessary to go to the main courses. And even then, the best of the main courses tend to be sort of appetizers writ large, like big plates of fried clams or fried oysters or fish and chips. I think you're getting the idea. Fried seafood.
Is this a good place to get a really big lobster?
Yeah, I mean, you know they're going to get good lobsters. You know they're going to cook them correctly. And they serve them with drawn butter completely simply. No gimmicks, no secret sauces, nothing but butter and lemon. But that's the way lobsters are supposed to be eaten anyway, I think.
When you were eating there, did a lot of people around you seem to be ordering the New England boiled dinner?
Well, I ordered the New England boiled dinner, though same Providence friend pointed out to me that nobody would ever call it that there, that it would be called a clam bake. And what you get in the dinner is what you would get in a clam bake, I guess. You get, you know, steamed mussels, steamed soft-shell clams with their siphons sticking out, a little bit of lobster, some linguica sausage, and a really super sweet chunk of grilled corn.
Mm. Sounds good, actually.
It is good. The Portuguese fish stew sounds like a completely different dish, but is pretty much the same, except there's hake instead of the lobster, and the broth is a little bit spicier, but otherwise it's pretty similar.
Mm. Wow. What was your favorite thing that you ate, if you can name one thing?
It's hard to say. There were a lot of good things. There was a giant grilled scallop served in a shell with just some lemon and some butter that was wonderful. I liked the clam cakes a lot, and I like having a big plate of steamed clams. I mean, who wouldn't love that?
Now, what about the dessert menu? It seems to be geared toward everyone's inner child.
It's an interesting menu. It's very plain. This stuff tends to be super rich. So there's like house-made ice cream, and it's made by the same pastry chef that is at Providence. And you can get hot fudge on it, but the interesting thing is wet nuts, which is a New England thing of walnuts boiled in a light syrup. It's kind of delicious. There's Indian pudding, which you see a lot in New England, never here, which is, you know, cornmeal and molasses boiled into sort of a hot, steaming hockey puck with ice cream on it. And blondies, which is something I'd never thought I'd recommend as a dessert at a nice restaurant, but it's probably the same blondies you used to make when you were in 11th grade, except maybe 10 times better.
10 times more butter, for sure.
There's so much butter. But again, you'd think it would be a fancy place, but it's not fancy at all. It's a place you could probably go to once a week for seafood and a glass of beer and some oysters. We haven't talked about the oysters, which are maybe the best in L.A. right now.
Really?
Not only do they have a lot of interesting types, including ones I've never seen before, but the way they open it and serve it is such that every half shell is filled to the brim with brine. I mean, it's almost as if they don't spill a drop.
That's incredible.
And it's super cold and super chilled. And yeah, sure, they have the usual horseradish and mignonette and lemon on it, but you're probably not going to use any of them. The oysters are just as good as they get in Los Angeles.
This sounds wonderful. Thank you, Jonathan.
Thank you.
That was Jonathan Gold, the Pulitzer Prize-winning food writer for the LA Times. We've been talking about Connie and Ted's in West Hollywood at Santa Monica and Havenhurst. You can get a text message with the restaurant's address and Jonathan's recommended dishes by texting Good Food to the number 69866. That's Good Food to 69866. Plus, find all the restaurants you hear about on Good Food on our restaurant map. Find it on the Good Food blog. Now let's compare Jonathan's review of Connie and Ted's with some Yelp reviews. The following is a sampling of comments and quotes taken from Connie and Ted's Yelp page in the last week. Let's start with the one-star review.
Their website says, if you are more than 15 minutes late for your reservation, you'll lose your table. Well, we got there on time, and 20 minutes after our reservation time, we still don't have a table. Total douchebag fest, too. This place sucks.
Now, a two-star review.
Overhyped. Wow, I've really been looking forward to trying Connie and Ted's, but what a freaking disappointment. My official rating is 2.5 stars, 5.0 for the ambiance, decor, outstanding and attentive service, and a big fat bagel for actual food. It's substance versus style. These guys are all style and no substance in my book.
And this is a 3-star review.
Okay. Yes, after my fifth visit, I'm updating my review. Here's the bottom line. No fluff, no frills. It's a corporate shill. No different than Marie Callender's or Claim Jumper, just with better food. Yes, the food is good, beyond good sometimes. But after being here a few times, it's beyond whitewashed and generic.
Now 4 stars.
Never did I imagine the ability of experiencing a true New England seafood or crab shack in LA, but owner and chef extraordinaire Michael Simoresti has done that at his new venture, Connie and Ted's. Leave your misconceptions of East Coast seafood at home as Connie and Ted's bring alive true crab shack dining as New Englanders know them to be.
And what does the Yelper say when he or she awards a whopping 5 stars?
OMG, Connie and Ted's is my new favorite restaurant. Sunday, August 4th, 2013, 3 p.m., late lunch. I've been wanting to try the fish and chips since my coworker was making me salivate while describing the dish to me last week. Man, they do not disappoint. Not only was the cod flaky, the batter was light and the fries, some of the best in L.A. Ordered shrimp cocktail as an app, and they were huge. My hubby and bestie loved the clam chowder, and my niece said their burger was great, too. I cannot wait for our return visit.
Sounds to me like all these Yelpers could use the help of Hannah Raskin. She's the incoming food writer for the Charleston Post and Courier and the author of Yelp Help, How to Write a Great Online Restaurant Review. So all of you budding food critics out there, listen up. Hannah's with me, and she's going to give you some pointers. Hi, Hannah.
Hi, Evan.
I'm so curious about this. You're a restaurant critic who has been working in traditional print media that now also has an online face. Why are you interested in making better what some people think is sort of a junk field of poorly written opinions by people who don't have a clue?
There is some of that, but my feeling is that it is such a tremendous resource to have a forum in which diners can chronicle the experiences they have eating out, because there is simply no way that those of us who are fortunate enough to do this professionally can eat everywhere. And so we are all dependent on civilian eaters to do this and tell us how it goes.
So take us through your guidance. What are the biggest errors that are being made?
Sure. I think one major mistake is people tend to write about themselves instead of the restaurant. And I think you always need to keep the reader in mind and think about, gosh, you know, if I wanted to learn about this restaurant, what would I want to know? And typically what you want to know is not whose birthday you were celebrating at that restaurant or, you know, your opinion of the curtains, because none of that really contributes to the experience that everyone else is going to have. That's really just about you. So I think the most important thing you can do is think about the restaurant as a whole. Think about, you know, what is its lasting impression? And I advise eaters to sometimes wait before posting. I think, you know, spending the night thinking about what's really stood out to you can be very valuable. And then just a few examples that illustrate your point. I think way too many reviews tend to go on and on and on. One of the big errors I see is just the chronological retelling, saying, well, we got out of the car. First, it was hard to find a parking space. And that really is not the most compelling way to introduce someone to a restaurant you loved.
It also has nothing to do with the restaurant. I mean, I find that I use those kinds of reviews if I'm looking at Yelp as a way of just dismissing what that particular person has to say.
That's exactly right. And I think so often these very simple mistakes, for instance, I talk in the book about how frequently people in Yelp will say, and it was the best taco I ever had. And as soon as I see that, I thought, well, you know, you're probably not the most discerning diner. And I'm probably going to write off most of what you said, even if you went on in the next paragraph to describe guacamole in terms that, you know, deserves a Pulitzer Prize. You really have to be careful about not making those simple mistakes that are going to give people a chance to ignore everything else you say.
Do you think that the civilian writers should visit a restaurant more than once before they write it?
I think if they can, that's great. I mean, I think I really feel that one of the problems with professional criticism is for too long it's been too secretive about how it does what it does. And so I think kind of taking this open source approach is great for everybody. Should they go back as many times as a professional critic did? You know, if time and budget allow, terrific. But I think the most important thing is just being transparent. So saying, I only went once, or I went three times because my cousin owns the restaurant. I mean, I think the more you can be upfront about your relationship to the restaurant, the more helpful it's going to be.
So this next question, I think, is the all-important one that I think is just like a minefield. What set of criteria should a critic or a civilian critic judge a restaurant by?
We kind of instinctively understand that there are different types of movies or different types of TV shows, and that, you know, if you go into a sci-fi thriller and you don't end up laughing, nobody complains. But it's very different in a restaurant. If you go into a restaurant and, you know, nobody comes over to offer you a sample of wine and it turns out, you know, you're in a dumpling joint, and still on Yelp, people will complain, you know, why wasn't I treated this way? Why isn't I treated that way? So it's really important that diners figure out what is the restaurant they're in trying to accomplish. Not what do they wish the restaurant was, not what is kind of restaurant they would open if they were a restaurateur, but what is that restaurant trying to accomplish, and does it succeed in doing so?
And how long should they be? How many words should, let's say, a Yelp review have?
Enough. I mean, I think, you know, some of people sometimes put up a sentence or two, and I don't think that's worth anyone's time. Probably not too many. And I think what lies between, you know, not enough and too many, probably 400 to 500 words.
How accurate do you think the star system is that's used on Yelp?
I think it's a mess. I think, I mean, it's awful. There are no guidelines as to what those stars mean. And so everybody has a different sense. And I think, you know, some people suggested even if they used letter grades, at least people would have a better idea. But I think there are some people who think, you know, who take a 3-star as their starting point, others the 1-star, others, you know, they go in and give, think every restaurant's a 5-star unless, you know, they find a cockroach in their food and they grade down from there. So there's absolutely no unanimity on what all these stars mean.
Thank you so much, Hannah.
Thank you, Evan. I really appreciate it.
Hannah Raskin is the new food writer for the Charleston Post and Courier and the author of Yelp Help: How to Write Great Online Restaurant Reviews. Coming up, summer may be over, but man, is it still hot outside. We've got some ideas to beat the heat in your kitchen. Stay close.
Good Food is produced by KCRW, a listener-supported public radio station in Los Angeles, California. Support our programming by making a donation. Go to kcrw.com/join.
Welcome back to Good Food. Maybe you're a fan of Greek or Persian yogurt-based salads and dips, but have you gone so far as to turn that delicious tzatziki into a soup? Well, food writer, journalist, and food editor at the LA Times, Russ Parsons, gives us a break from the stove with a reintroduction to the idea of a cold dairy soup for dinner. I am such a slavish lover of any kind of yogurty, cucumbery combo.
Oh, I love them. And it's one of those things, like when you look at Hungarian cookbooks and the Balkans, they're full of using yogurts and buttermilks and kvass and kind of tangy fermented dairy products cold as a base for soups. And they're really, really delicious. And for some reason, it's something that we've kind of forgotten about. You know, I mean, people know about gazpacho and then cold avocado soups and these kinds of soups. But the dairy-based soups seem to have gotten lost in the mesh someplace.
Which is interesting because we're eating more and more kefir.
Right.
Which, you know, has its fair share of calories if it's made with whole milk and you're just drinking it all down. And this is sort of like giving those bases a pride of place in a bowl.
Right, right. Because we're eating and drinking so much of it now, there are so many different options that are available and so much better quality that's available. It used to be to find good yogurt was something of a challenge. But now
it's overwhelming.
It's like, okay, which kind of yogurt do you want? And do you want goat's milk or do you want cow's milk? Do you want it this way? Do you want it that way?
Do you want Indian or Armenian?
Right. It's wonderful. That sour dairy flavor complements so many different things. And especially in the summertime when it's like, you know, you just get home and it's like, oh my God. They come together really quickly and they embrace so many different things you have in the refrigerator anyways.
What is our base?
Well, it depends. You can do a base with yogurt and milk. I really like buttermilk. You know, my dad is from North Dakota, and when he was growing up, one of their popular Depression dishes was buttermilk soup, which was buttermilk and bread. And you just crumbled up the bread and tossed it in the buttermilk. And that was, you know, that would be dinner. I think there were probably some, you know, chopped green onions in it and things like that. But, you know, you can do so many different things with it.
Now, the things that we want to do with it, are we looking towards these particular kinds of ethnic cuisines that use sour cream or yogurt or buttermilk often?
Well, we can, and I think we kind of do, but from a distance. You know, we're in Los Angeles, right? And so, you know, it's like what I know about Turkish cuisine, I know my idea of Turkish cuisine is, and I've eaten in some Turkish restaurants, and I love the food, and I've cooked from Turkish cookbooks. Do I really understand it as well as I could or have like a definitive knowledge of it? No. But, you know, you take cucumbers and yogurt and make a soup from that and then add some crushed walnuts to it, a little bit of paprika, some green onions. It's like, I don't know that that's Turkish, but it's the turkey of my mind.
It's so delicious. When you talk about adding cucumbers to a dairy soup, are you doing slices or dices? Are you grating?
I usually grate them. I grate them and then drain them to get some of the water out.
Do you spoon out the seeds in the center of the cucumber?
It depends on the kind of cucumber. Like if I'm using Kirby's or something like that from the farmer's market where there's a definite seed package, I do. If I'm using those little Armenian cucumbers, the seeds are so small, I don't find it to be that intrusive. And again, it's like so much of it is just like what seems right to you as the cook at the moment. Do you want to peel the cucumber or not? Well, I mean, if it's been waxed, if it's a supermarket cucumber, it's got one of the waxy coatings and that the green peel tends to be really bitter anyways. Nah, get rid of that. But if it's like if it's one of those really sweet little Armenian type cucumbers, oh yeah, leave it unpeeled. It adds a nice fleck of green to it.
Yeah, really, really pretty. Now, are we eating these soups as soon as we whisk the ingredients together, or do they need to chill a little bit first?
You can eat. They're okay as soon as you make them. But I do think that chilling them for a little bit while you go out to the porch and have a drink or something like that, I think that improves the flavor. I think it really mellows it. But one thing that you need to be really careful about is when you do that, you want to be sure that you taste it again before you serve it. Because one of the things that happens when you chill foods is that the flavors get damped down pretty much. So you're going to want to correct the salt. You're going to want to correct the acidity. Those two things are the real prime flavors that you're going to want to have prominent.
Also, they tend to thicken a little bit as they chill.
Yes, they thicken a little bit as they chill, and especially depending on what the other ingredients are. For example, I made one with barley, which was a great full meal kind of soup, but the barley did absorb more of the liquid as it sat. So then I had to thin it, you know, be careful and thin it with a little bit more milk before I served it. On the other hand, if you're using cucumbers, and cucumbers by themselves, they've been seasoned, the salt, the acidity is going to pull water from the cucumber, so they may be a little bit thin. So you might want to start with a combination that's a little bit thicker than you would otherwise, because you can always go back and add a little bit of milk, but it's hard to, if the soup has become watery, it's more difficult to correct that than it is a too thick soup.
What other ingredients were in the soup that had the barley?
Well, the barley soup was the kind of the Turkish influenced one. This isn't an authentic dish at all, but like cucumbers and cooked barley and yogurt and garlic. I used a little bit of jalapeno in there just to give it a little bit of a bite. Some red onions and then chopped up some mint and some dill and walnuts on top. And then just a sprinkling of paprika for color, but also a little bit of that fire, too.
You know, there's something about that combination for me that just sounds incredible. On one hand, it's sort of like a gruel with the addition of the barley. But that's what will make it really a whole meal.
I mean, if you did it just with the barley, it would be gruelish. But because of everything else, it's like the barley just becomes the substance of it. Thinking about those ingredients again, maybe it's Russian. Sounds vaguely Georgian to me, too.
Sounds Georgian. It also sounds Persian to me. I mean, the idea of having the cucumbers, the onions, or shallots, and then
walnuts. Exactly.
If we haven't added a grain to it, would you serve some of these dairy soups as an appetizer dish, or what would we have on the side to make it a little bit more filling?
I think these things really need to have grains added to them, and that's a fairly light meal. If you're doing just the cold soup, I mean, it's a real, you know, kind of wake up. It's an appetizer kind of thing, but it's kind of like gazpacho, where it's something that kind of shocks you into being hungry again, which is not the ideal situation if you're not going to serve anything else with it.
You actually had that experience once.
I had that experience, yes. One of the first big deal meals I ever cooked was showing off for my parents. It was a Hungarian cherry soup from one of Richard Olney's books. I was so proud of myself, and I went through and did the whole thing. But it was just basically like cherries with a little bit of wine and some sour cream. And, you know, it's like I served it. And okay, what's next? We went out for hamburgers, I'm afraid.
Oh, that's so funny. Well, I think that the perfect follow-up to a soup of this kind is just beautiful vegetables.
Yeah, I mean, beautiful vegetables or, you know, staying with that Central European, Middle Eastern theme, grilled skewers of some kind, something like that on a salad. I think that would be a great meal by itself.
Oh, and that's good because we can cook those grilled skewers outside.
Yeah.
Very good. Thank you so much.
Oh, thanks for having me.
Russ Parsons is the food editor at the LA Times. We've been talking about cold dairy soups to beat the heat. If you missed any part of today's show, you can listen anytime you want at kcrw.com or via iTunes. You can also find Good Food on Demand on KCRW's apps for the iPod, Android, and BlackBerry. I hope to see you later today at the 5th Annual Good Food Pie Contest at LACMA. It's really fun for eaters. A big thanks to the Good Food team, Jillian Larrell, Sarah, Harriet, Ronnie, and Gary. I'm Evan Kleiman. Join me back here next week for another edition of Good Food.